The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation on the Catholic Channel about the Church and the world. We kind of say just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And the world will be a more just and a more compassionate place. And we speak with those people who try to do that, to make our world more compassionate. And so today's conversation is, again, about our responsibility to protect and to preserve creation, the environment, which kind of we share with God and God made, and we have some responsibility to steward it. And what we're hearing today is that some people don't have enough of the natural resources to do. So we're going to speak today with Gary White, who is the CEO and co-founder of water.org. And then a little bit later in the show, we're going to speak with Mathis Wackernagel, who is the president of Global Footprint Network. And that one I'm intrigued by, because that we kind of learn about a footprint, and there's a thing called a budget for a footprint, and sometimes you do too much of a footprint and stuff like that. And so I'm looking forward to that, as I am with our first conversation in a few minutes with Gary White, because one of those things about water is everybody knows about water, but yet I bet you, to our listeners out there, there are things about water that you don't know that you're going to know in the next half hour. And so I encourage you to listen to what we're going to learn about water, how important it is, and actually how the reality is that, you know, despite water everywhere, there are a lot of people in the world who don't have enough water that they drink every day. So I'm excited about that. So Tom, no more big trips? Or, well, actually, didn't you after your Italy trip, didn't you head out to Seattle or somewhere?
I did, Monsignor. I headed out to Portland, Oregon. And it was for the Social Action Summer Institute of the Roundtable, which is an association of social
action
directors.
Oh, my God. That's so many words. I mean,
it's too many words. That's what we always wind up saying it is. But it was really beautiful, Monsignor. I say I've never been actually in that part of the world before. And just the physical beauty of the place was incredible. I mean, we were able to get out to the Columbia River Gorge and just to be.
But not as beautiful as the sidewalks and the streets and the asphalts of New York City.
Indeed. I would say there's a particular beauty that I think New York has, and as a lifelong New Yorker, of course, I really I appreciate that. And Portland City.
So where were you? In Canada? Were you in Canada?
No, we weren't in Canada.
Oh, so it's Portland.
It was Portland, actually. You know, but I didn't realize, you know, Portland's actually geographically further north than New York is.
Right.
But it's much cooler out there, which is really kind of interesting because, I mean, they don't.
Well, hold on for a second, Tom, I got to stop you. Things that are further north in the northern hemisphere tend to be cooler. Things further south in the southern hemisphere tend
true.
To be cooler.
Yeah, you're right.
So that's not a great insight.
It's true. I would say, well, you know, I think the thing that kind of got me.
Anything else you want to share with us?
Well, yes, I was going to say, I think it was the extremes of the temperature, though, because I was talking to people there, and they said that during the wintertime, it's apparently a very temperate place, so they don't get a lot of snow. But then during the summertime, it doesn't get much hotter either. So it was kind of interesting. And I have to say, the physical beauty is magnificent. If you go right outside of Portland, there's this Columbia River Gap that is just, it's beautiful. It cuts through the mountains. And the Columbia River, obviously, is very important to the salmon industry and other industries like that. And they've done actually a lot of work to try to clean up the Columbia River.
Did you do any work while you were there? Since this was a business trip, did you do any work?
I did do work once.
So let me share with our listeners. Now, what Tom went to is a pretty important thing, and it relates very much to our show. You know, over the past 30, 40 years, one of the things that the church throughout the country has tried to be faithful to the fact that in addition to us celebrating the sacraments, in addition to us passing on the faith through our Catholic schools, in addition to the services that we provide to people, that part of our social mission is to try to make our world, as we say on Just Love, more compassionate, more just. And so a number of dioceses throughout the countries have kind of, you know, assigned people and sometimes offices, not usually a whole lot of them, but to make sure that the church stays a little bit on target with regard to some of those things that are related to the services we provide,
But they kind of look at some of the root causes of those. They look at some of the public policies that are around, see how maybe people can be empowered to help themselves through organizing. And they kind of formed an organization called the Social Action Directors throughout the country. And, you know, I think they had illusions of grandeur. They thought they were of King Arthur and the Knight, so they called it the Round Table to do that. And that's the meeting that Tom mm-hmm. was at. Now, I got to tell our listeners a little bit of a story, because somebody who we worked with quite a lot over the years, who passed away probably more than a decade or so ago, Harry Fagan, who was a great church organizer, founded the Round Table. And Harry always used to give his talk at the beginning of these sessions. And he said, you know, guys, what the church and the world needs less of is grim do-gooders. And I got to tell you, sometimes when you go to these meetings with the people who are trying to save the world, you kind of say, could we like smile a little bit? I mean, yes, we know there are serious problems. We know there's poverty, but, you know, could we not? So Tom, I want to know, was it a grim bunch of do-gooders, or what do you think?
It wasn't so grim this time, Monsieur. Actually, I mean, we were talking about very serious issues, but I think actually Pope Francis has kind of lifted a lot of people's grimness, if you will. I think his approach that he used in his most recent encyclical, I think, is a very positive approach. I think honestly, people are a little less grim. There's still obviously some folks who, you know, like to talk about and dwell on the grim facts, but we did discuss Harry Fagan, Monsignor, and we did mention that very famous saying of his. So we're trying to be very mindful not to bring too much grim into our work.
You know, Harry's other great, great line was when Harry told great stories, oftentimes about organizing, about works for social justice, or just stories in general. And they were fantastic stories. And there was somebody who was new to the group there who said to him, Harry, is that story true? And without missing a beat, Harry said, all stories are true. Some of them actually happened. With that, we're going to go to our first guest, who is Gary White, who is the CEO and co-founder of Water.org. And quite frankly, we're going to talk about a very serious topic, which is water in the world, something that I suspect that probably 95% of our listeners today take for granted. I bet you that our listeners, you know, they go to the sink, they turn it on, and they assume that you're going to get clean water that you can drink. But we're going to talk with Gary White about not so much for lots of people in our world. Gary, thanks so much for taking the time to come into the studio today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Good. So tell me, Gary, how'd you get into water?
Well, it's a long story, but basically, for me, it was this intersection of engineering and the world's greatest need, right? When I think of the, my upbringing through Catholic schools and Catholic family, really understanding that there is a need to drive for social justice, and that was instilled in me from an early age. But then I also knew that I had this passion for engineering. And so when I looked at, you know, where does social justice and engineering intersect, I just came down squarely around water and, equally important, sanitation.
Wow. I love engineers. You know, I love engineers because they look at the world, and not negatively, but they look mm-hmm. at the world as a problem to be solved. Mm-hmm. And they almost regard it as a challenge. How can we make this better? Mm-hmm. You know, they don't get stymied. Mm-hmm. You know, a problem is something you got to deal with. And so mm-hmm. And they get to it. So I'm delighted that you chose to kind of focus your professionalism on the issue of water.
Well, thanks. And I'll take that as a compliment. And I think you intended it that way. Because for me, it is about solving problems, but it's about going one step further as well. It's about trying to optimize the solutions, you know, if you let me kind of throw that engineering word in there. Because I think the people of the world that we're trying to serve.
Optimizing solutions means you got a good solution, find a better one.
Let's make it better.
But, you know, let's give our listeners a sense. Because I think in the United States, where most of our listeners are throughout the country, as I said, you turn on the water, it comes out. Mm-hmm. Maybe some places it's a little bit worse than others, or sometimes we get upset if it's a little rusty and you just let mm-hmm. it run for a while and you've solved your problem. But I was looking at some of the stuff. Boy, lots of people in the world don't have access to good water, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, it is something that we take for granted. And it's a problem that we solved more than 100 years ago in this country. And we know how to make water safe, so we should be able to solve this problem, or more importantly, help people, give them the tools that they need in order to solve the problem on their own.
So give a give our listeners a sense. How big? A few thousand people don't have enough water?
I wish it were that low. It's really closer to about 750 million people who don't have access to water, and about 2.6 billion without access to improved sanitation.
Whoa, 2.6 billion.
Yes.
Whoa. And but let's just take that for a moment. Mm-hmm. What'd you say, about 750 million?
Without improved water supplies.
Without improved water supplies. And what's that mean? Does it mean they don't get good water? Is that what it means?
Yeah, it means a couple of things. One, it means that they're oftentimes drinking contaminated water.
Ooh.
It means that they're drinking from open streams sometimes. Oh. It means that they're drinking from ditches running through urban areas. And it means that they're getting sick and dying by the millions every year. And it's also the time cost associated with walking great distances many times to collect water.
Hey, I saw that. I saw that. That boy, if you were paying a minimum wage, isn't there a lot of hours put in every day by kids and women who are doing what I saw you using? How many hours?
Well, in terms of kids, it's about 443 million school days that are lost every year because of walking to collect water and water disease. For women, it's about 200 million hours every day that women walk to collect water.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a huge. Lot. Yeah. That's a lot. I mean, so when we talk about 750 million people without, good access to clean water or something, that stuff, what do we got in the country? About 300 million people in the United States?
Yeah.
So, more than twice the number of people in the United States throughout the world don't have access to clean water.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Engineer, solve the problem. So what's going on?
Well,
what are you doing?
I think that, water.org is a charity. It's a nonprofit. So we do raise charitable capital, philanthropic capital, we say. But it's going to take more than that. There's never going to be enough charity in the world to get water and sanitation to everybody who needs it.
Right.
And so what we're looking at is how do we solve this problem in a less, in fairly new and innovative way. And what we see and have seen over the years is that a lot of people living in poverty actually have the ability to make these improvements themselves if they can just get access to capital.
Ah.
And so what we're looking at is using microfinance, small loans, sometimes as little as $200 to help people build toilets at their home or to get water connections to public utilities.
So give our listeners a very practical sense of this. And I think you just hit on it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned toilets and you mentioned connections. Why is it that so many people don't have water and they have to walk together? I mean, for me, who's not an engineer, I said, they're not pipes that bring it to them. Is that what we need? What's the problem?
Well, I mean, poverty is definitely the root of it. But if you look at the poor, there's different levels of poverty. And certainly there are some people in the world who are so absolutely poor. We need to give them basically a subsidized approach, help them through charitable purposes.
Right.
But there's literally hundreds of millions who lack access to capital as a tool. They're still very poor. We're helping people surviving on as little as $1.25 a day. But what they're also doing is they're spending tremendous amounts of their income to pay water vendors to distribute water in their neighborhoods. It's very expensive, about 10 to 15 times more per liter if you do that than if you connect to the utility.
Okay.
But the utility requires a connection fee. So you don't have that $150 or $200 all at once, but you do have, the 10 cents a day to pay the vendor.
So, so let's translate this and see if I get this right. If I don't, you're going to correct me on this. So sometimes in places in the United States, when there's a new development that I think, at least years ago, I don't know if it still goes because I'm not an engineer, they used to put in septic systems. And so people had septic systems and stuff like that. And then after a number of years, they said, well, wait a minute, we should connect to the main water supply. But then people had to pay more taxes or there was an assessment.
Exactly.
In order, it may not be the same commas and zeros, but is that kind of what what you're talking about in some of those places?
The infrastructure has to be paid for, and the poor should pay a disproportionately smaller amount of that infrastructure, but there's still a rational reason to charge for water, to charge for these services, but charging at a rate that the poor can afford. And that's really what we're trying to do, help them get access to the same infrastructure that everybody else in these cities has access to, so that they can become customers and tap into their power as customers and as citizens rather than just recipients of charity.
You know, we're speaking with Gary White, who is the co-founder of water.org, who is an engineer and is trying to do his part to solve the problem of lack of access to water in the world. And so, Gary, you know, we got a lot of people. You said 750,000 people without 750 million people without access to billion people. I'm sorry, million people. Mm-hmm. We only got 6 billion in the whole world. I'm getting confused here. So, but anyway, but if we look at that, and I know that's a lot. We making any progress? We getting better? We getting worse? Or where are we doing?
We're certainly making progress. Oh, if you rewind to 1990, during that time, more than 2 billion people, closer to 2.3 billion people, have gained access to water for the first time.
Wow.
So that's happening. And I think a lot of that is happening because of the good news, really. And you hear Bill Gates talk about this often, because so many billions of people have been lifted out of poverty during that time. And so those people, one of the first things that they want to do once they get lifted out of poverty is improve their water and sanitation, especially if they're in urban areas, because they know the opportunity cost of all this time spent collecting water, paying these water vendors. And so many people have gotten to water and sanitation really through their own, but a lot of times they're doing it through loan sharks. I've met women, you know, in countries around the world who are paying loan sharks 125% interest to get loans to build a toilet or to build a rainwater harvesting system in rural areas and so on. So what we're trying to do is to bring that affordable capital to them through water credit.
That is intriguing, and I think is one of the things you've talked about. And as with my experience is with all good international aid organizations, they understand you got to do some charitable work, and you have to help people to make it through the day, make it through a crisis. But you also have to help people to take a step forward so that they can begin to care for themselves. And I think that's what you're talking about is an important part of what water.org does.
It is. And it's, you know, oftentimes I talk about it as nudges, right? We have this global order, if you will. We have, you know, capitalism that exists out there. We have markets that exist out there. That's the way it is. And, you know, for us, it's about nudging that system a little bit so that it goes a little bit more in the favor of the poor. And I think that's really what we're trying to do. You know, that I oftentimes talk about lighting a candle versus cursing the darkness. I mean, to me, if I just go to the UN and plant a flag and say everybody should have water for free, we just need to raise all the charity, go do it, I mean, I'm not going to get anywhere. I'm trying to lead the organization in a way where we can light the candle and say, this is what the hand that we're dealt. How do we tilt the odds in the favor of the poor?
When we look at what's going on in the world, and, you know, maybe it is getting a little bit better, I think one of the things that's really important is to communicate that. And I know I spoke with somebody within the past 6 months, we were dealing with food throughout the world. And again, some of the advances have really increased productivity in some developing countries so that the acreage is yielding a whole lot more than it was. And I think that's kind of important, is because, you know, when you hear 750 million people, they don't have access to clean water. You hear 2.6 billion people are not in good sanitary hygiene. You say, oh, my God, what can I do? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, you know, I can't do anything. I might as well just give up. Mm-hmm. But you're telling us that progress is being made.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for me, you know, you're talking about getting more food out of an acre of land. What we're talking about with water.org is getting more people with safe water for philanthropic dollar invested. So if we're doing this with loans, basically we can multiply the number of people, you know, over a 10-year period, we can get to two or three times as many people with a loan approach as opposed to just if we had drilled a well for them and given it away for free.
Now, I'm sure that because of, you know, if you're drilling a well or if you're attaching it to water, sometimes you're making an impact on a whole neighborhood or a community, not just an individual. Am I right with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly in some rural areas where poverty is just off the charts, those types of solutions still need to happen. Governments still need to step up and provide that infrastructure. But with those shared systems where many families are using one well, they can afford the operations and maintenance on that independent. So it's just getting them over the hump of that capital investment.
Tell our listeners your favorite success story.
I think my favorite success story, there's a lot of them. And I think
I'll give you two.
But I think, well, the one that I'll hit on was the woman I met in Bangalore, India, a couple of years ago. And she was living in the slum. She was buying her water from these water vendors, paying 20 rupees a day for her water for her family of five. And they were paying about 20 rupees a day to use the toilet in the slum. And so about 40 rupees a day.
How much does that translate?
60 rupees is a dollar. So it's a little bit less than a dollar.
Right.
And so if you multiply that up, that's about 1,200 rupees a month. Right. So she took out a water credit loan for a toilet for her family.
Right.
And she took out a loan for a water connection. Her loan payments each month for about 2 years was going to be 1,200 rupees a month. Once she got her loans repaid, then that's all income. Other than her small water bill she'd still be paying, that's going to be income that comes back into her family. They can invest in education. They can invest in more nutritious food and so on. So that, to me, really speaks to how, you know, it's the thing, Matt Damon's our co-founder of the organization, and I love one of the things that he always talks about, and that's he says it's really expensive to be poor. And I think that's exactly what it was for that woman, that it's really expensive for her not to have access to capital.
Well, you know, what you say, Gary, I think is 100% correct. And I mean, it's interesting. And there are lots of different arguments about neighborhood grocers and neighborhood businesses in the cities of New York and the big box stores and all of those type of things. But it really is an issue that sometimes people in poorer neighborhoods are always paying a premium in whether it be on food, whether it be retail, and for a variety of reasons. And it's kind of one of those things where you say, well, gee, you like the neighborhood guy who's doing business. You don't want to get him to be out of work or get her not to be able to run her shop. But at the same time, the poor people in the neighborhood are paying, you know, a 25%, 30% premium for their. So it's kind of like, you, how do you balance it? That's what's kind of a hard thing.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Now, Gary, one thing, like, you've been generous with your time. I'm only going to keep you a couple of more minutes. We're going to make you the czar of water for the whole world. What's the one or two things you would do to kind of give more people access to water?
Well, that's a great question because, you know, we always come at it from a sense of humility. Like, what can we get done as this NGO? And that's why we kind of work from the bottom up. And that needs to happen. But I think if I were the czar, I'd be working a lot more from the top down.
Okay.
I would really see governments investing more in the infrastructure to improve it so that people can get better access to it. So there's so much underinvestment in water and sanitation infrastructure around the world because it's just not made a priority. And it's not made a priority primarily because it's a problem of the poor. So I would see that investment go up. And then what we're doing from the bottom up can meet that capital from the top down. And I think we could get access to water and sanitation in our lifetime without much trouble.
Gary White, the CEO and the co-founder of Water.org, thank you for taking the time to be with us. I know I got a little bit smarter, and I think that our listeners did too. So thanks so much for sharing us, and I think I'll vote. You're my czar of water.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're going to take a two-minute break, so join us when we come back on Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, we say just love, and it's got really two meanings. We say just love because we say only love, and love, if we do that, our world will be more just and more compassionate. But we say just because just kind of is the first part of justice. And if we really understood love, love is not merely kind of emotional stuff. It's not merely romance, although that's wonderful and good. And love is not merely charity where I kind of reach out to somebody in need and give them something they need. But love is really wanting the best for the other person. And so love wants a world in which everybody's rights and responsibilities are both respected and fulfilled. And so when we say just love, what we mean is that love contains justice, that the fullness of love contains both charity, it contains justice, it really contains willing the good of another person. And a little bit of my own take on this stuff. I know sometimes there is a little bit of a tension sometimes between the people who say, well, you know, I really want to help somebody. I want to give them a meal. I want to, help them to get through the day. And then other people who say, well, but that's just a Band-Aid. It's just kind of not going to solve the problem. I want to organize. I want to change the law. I want to make a better policy on this. And, they're both right and they're both wrong. It's not about both, because we do need to try to look at the root causes of why people need charity. And we also, at the same time, just can't wait for all the laws to be perfect, which they're never going to be, or the policies to change. We also have to help people in need, even as we're working to make policies better. And as we are helping people in need, we also have to be conscious that some of the laws and policies could have a big effect, if maybe not on the individual in front of us, but their children, the next generation, or their neighbors in making the place better. So when we say just love, we say justice, we say charity, we say help the whole person with their immediate needs, but also let's look at what's going on in the world around us to see if we can make our world more just and better ordered, better structured. Well, too much, Tom. That was like, we didn't need another sermon or lecture by me on that. But every now and then I like to kind of let our listeners know why we have this title, Just Love. Anything interesting in the news?
Well, you know, Monsieur, you were mentioning the fact about how we have to be sure that everyone's rights are taken care of. You know, this is, if you will, the big week when we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. July 26th, the first President Bush, 1990, signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. And as you're aware, this landmark piece of legislation cemented equality for people with disability rights and ensure civil rights for peoples with disabilities, and it made sure they were protected from discrimination in the workplace and other places, and it mandated accessibility for public accommodation. So I think what you just mentioned has a great deal to do with, I think, the attitude that we have for our disabled brothers and sisters today.
Hey, let me tell you, Tom, I was listening to a show the other night on television about exactly the topic you're talking about, and there were three people who were there. One woman, two men, who were themselves had certain disabilities. Mm-hmm. And the conversation they had was absolutely incredible. There was no sense of self-pity. Mm-hmm. They were incredibly upbeat. They were just very, very grateful about the changes that have occurred over the past 25 years that have made their lives better. And if I can, I'll tell you, they were realistic. They said, we got other things we have to do and things of that nature. They said the subways aren't in New York City aren't so great. But they said, the buses are better. And so a lot of stuff. And they were really happy about the curb cuts.
Okay.
So the people with wheelchairs. Now, maybe not all of them. But I want to tell you about the woman who was there. And I don't remember. I think her name was Yian Horn. I don't remember her name, but she was so incredibly upbeat that it was funny. Because I'll tell you two parts of it. First part is somebody said, well, you know, what about when somebody reaches out to help you and they actually don't really help. They might, with a blind person, they don't. She said, yeah, I know. But my perspective is, at least they cared enough to want to help. She said, so she was really upbeat. But the other thing which I really liked, and this makes her a quintessential New Yorker. For those of you in the rest of the country, you'll get it. But if you're kind of in an area, you'll really get it. She said, you know, kind of what I like about, you know, she said, I look, sometimes I know I have a disability, but like when I go to a place like Disney World, I get to go to the front of the line. So I don't have to wait in the big line for it. And she said, you know, some of those restaurants that have big lines,
right,
I sometimes get to go front. So, awesome. I mean, you know, I got to tell, for those of you in the rest of the country, that is a typical kind of New Yorker approach. How do you take what is adversity and turn it into something for your advantage?
So, exactly,
Tom, we got any other news?
We do. You know, this past week, as you may be aware, and this kind of is on topic with what we're talking about today, Pope Francis actually called a meeting, and about 70 mayors from around the world went to the Vatican, and they had a conference there that was put on by the Academy of Sciences called Modern Slavery and Climate Change, A Commitment to Cities. And what the Pope did was he basically talked to them a little bit about his new encyclical about climate change, Laudate Si. And he also noted that, interestingly, there was a boomerang effect, that oftentimes what will happen is when there are climate adversities, people will migrate. They'll move to the cities, and oftentimes that puts people in vulnerable positions, that leaves them open to trafficking and leaves them open to those kinds of things. So our own mayor, Mayor de Blasio, actually participated in that, in that meeting. And as he said, he thought it was an extraordinary gathering. And he said that the Pope is showing a different kind of leadership by bringing together mayors from around the world. He said that to take action on climate change and human trafficking, he said that that was important because these people who are in local government want action now. So maybe by bringing the mayors together, he's encouraging the leaders of the countries to do more regarding both climate change and human trafficking.
All right. So we're going to continue to talk about the environment. We're going to continue to talk about what's going on in our world and how we need to be better in terms of stewarding that. When we come back, we'll speak with Mathis Wackernagel, who is the president of Global Footprint Network. And so we'll take a break now. And this is Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just 2 minutes on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Today's conversation on Just Love, we're talking about our responsibility to protect, preserve God's creation. What we're called today to assist in our own country, but assist throughout the world. We're dealing with issues of water. We're dealing with issues of how much of natural resources do each of us use, how much do we use as a society. And so we're going to speak in just a moment or two with Mathis Wackenmangel, who is the president of the Global Footprint Network. And we're going to speak about what's going on in our world and how we kind of can measure, figure out what we're doing in terms of using the resources that we have. And that's a critically important issue. It certainly is one of the things that was focused on in the recent encyclical by Pope Francis. And it's something that has become, part of our conversation in the world, which wasn't so maybe, 50, 75 years ago, but in the past decades, it's become a very important part of our conversation. So let's speak with Mathis now, the president of Global Footprint Network. Mathis Wackenmangel, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Great pleasure.
Good. I'm delighted that you are with us. So tell us a little bit about how you yourself got interested in this topic.
I grew up in Switzerland, and I had the pleasure to spend many of my vacations on a farm and helping a little bit with the cows and just kind of getting to see how much it takes to maintain cows and to milk cows, etc. And I think that influenced my view of the world to think about the world very much from a farmer's perspective, because ultimately an economy works very much like a cow, that like a cow eats, and then it produces milk, but it also poops, and the manure becomes, again, a fertilizer to produce more grass, etc. But there is a relationship between how big a farm is and how many cows can be sustained. And so that's a knowledge base that kind of got me intrigued and has followed me through my professional life.
That is a fascinating story. I like that. The earth is like a cow. I like that. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And I thought it was just about Dell computers. That's what I thought cows were about. But anyway, I love it. That is a great, great thing. So I'm fascinated. You have kind of developed something called an ecological footprint. What's that big word, big phrase mean?
Yeah. In essence, we are ecological accountants. And we look at the world, as I said, from a farmer's perspective. So on the one hand, we look at how big is the world? I mean, the world as a whole, the planet or a country. So how big is the farm called United States, or how big is the farm called California? And then we can compare that with how much capacity is actually needed to support our metabolism for all we eat, for all the fibers we use for our clothes, for the timber, to absorb our waste like CO2. So it all takes space. And then we can compare how many Californias does it take to support what Californians use today. And so that's what the ecological footprint does. It compares how much we use from nature with how much we have.
So I guess, let me see if I understand. I think I understood what you're saying is, do you come somehow develop, because one of the other things you talked about was kind of developing an ecological budget.
That's a very good way. It's like with money. We want to know how much do we earn, how much do we spend. And the same thing we can do with resources. We don't do that in money, but essentially with surface areas. We say how much surface area that is productive, that can provide things, does exist. That's like our income. And then how much area is needed to provide everything we consume, our orange juice, coffee, the cotton for our shirts, etc. And then we can compare the two.
And I guess, again, to just go one step further, so just to make sure I understand it, and if I can understand it, then our listeners can understand it, is that I guess we're talking about, because as with budgets and with everything, if I got some stuff in the bank, I can maybe spend more this year because I have stuff in the bank. But if I keep spending all of that, so there's going to come a time when I'm going to run out and I'm not going to be able to have enough to get by. And so the way I'm thinking about, you're talking about the kind of the ecological footprint and the ecological budget, what you're looking for is kind of like, if how much should Californians consume or use this year so that they're not going into either next year's or last year's, so that it's kind of sustainable over the long term. Did I get that somewhat right?
That's absolutely close. Actually, I had the pleasure to go to a class of 11-year-olds, and it was intriguing because young people, they think with a fresh mind. And so I asked them, so why would we want to measure how much nature we have compared to how much we use? And the girl immediately put up her hand and she said, oh, if we use more from nature than what nature can regenerate, the only thing left to eat is imaginary cookies. And I thought that was quite refreshing and interesting. Of course, she was slightly wrong because, as you said, if we have a bank account, we can use more than what we have for some time, but only for some time. It means we are eating up our inheritance. We're not leaving more to our next generation, and we put ourselves in danger. Now, we don't say like the Californians have to absolutely live within what California can regenerate, because we can import and we can export, etc. But just for the globe as a whole, we cannot import. So for the ultimate budget constraint is our planet. And so if we do use more than what we have, like in the case of California where I live, it's quite extreme. We use about eightfold what the ecosystems of California can renew. So it has to come from somewhere. And this imbalance could become an economic risk as well. So it's not just difficult for nature to use more, but it may have consequences quite directly for us as well.
We are speaking with Mathis Wackenhagel, the president of Global Footprint Network, and we're speaking about how we kind of balance what our use of the environment, the use of the resources of nature, and how much there is there and how they are sustainable. Mathis, in the work that you do, what do you see as the basic or the major challenges that you face in kind of doing the work that you do?
Yeah, we are very fortunate to live on an amazingly abundant planet, but still we treat it as if all nature was just free and infinite, rather than looking after it carefully as a farmer would do. And so the question is that really the wisest way to think about it? It's a bit like if we owned a house, we already paid down everything and say, oh, now it's free. So it's like it's a free house. But actually, we have to think, wow, if I didn't have the house, how much rent would I have to pay if I had to live somewhere else? So we should, I think, treat nature more carefully, because that's essentially what every process, every activity depends on. And so to understand how much we use compared to how much we have is quite fundamental. And I think that's something we probably don't pay enough attention to. We focus a lot on financial accounting, financial flows, and think, oh, resources are quite cheap, so we don't have to worry so much. But ultimately, physics prevails. And so I have to kind of, as a farmer, think, do we have enough farm for ourselves? In a world that moves more into a situation of potential climate change and resource constraints, can we really afford to be careless with our resources, or do we have to think more like farmers?
Now, Mathis, for our listeners throughout the United States primarily, let's get down to a few kind of practical things that I think, you know, a lot of people experience and maybe they deal with and maybe they don't deal with. Two things I'm going to mention. Those people who are involved in kind of building buildings, whether they are building an office building, they work in an office building, or in new construction of stuff. Everybody hears the phrase a LEEDs building, which I think it's an abbreviation, but it's got something to do with making a building that is more environmentally friendly, more ecologically efficient. Does that matter?
Absolutely, does it matter? It's one of the way we build our cities and our houses is absolutely fundamental. I mean, just to take an extreme case, it's still macro, and then we bring it down to the every person's lives. If you look at how cities are constructed, if you compare a city like, for example, in the Mediterranean area that was built before we had cars, they're very compact, and so people can walk around. like, for example, Siena or Rome or places like that, or Barcelona. Then we compare that to places that were much more built with a car in mind, like Atlanta or Houston. The difference in resource demand per person may be about fourfold. So, and then you say, does it impact quality of life? And for many people, they say, oh, actually, living in a place like Rome or in Siena, that's quite nice. It may not be worse, or maybe actually better even than living in Houston. So resource demand and quality of life are not that strongly, or can be decoupled, and particularly if we have well-designed cities. And well-designed cities includes also well-designed houses. So if we have a house that is really energy efficient, then we know that for the lifetime of the house, we have great services, great comfortable living that doesn't depend so much on resources that may become more scarce or more difficult to get by. So it's really also at the same time an economic value creation. It's not just a giving up for the planet. It's of course, it's also good for the environment to have ecologically efficient housing, but it also in the end for the pocketbook, we recognize, wow, this is an investment that will hold its value.
Now, so let me get very specific on something. You talked about a big building in general. But I mean, one of the things that I think, again, people at a very micro level at least sometimes deal with, or they see other people deal with, is kind of solar energy and solar panels that are on,
yes,
on buildings. I mean, yes, do they work?
Absolutely. I just got some myself.
Well, but you don't count. It's like if I told people I prayed, that doesn't count. It's part of my job. So
that's so sweet of you. Actually, my mother was she lives in Switzerland. She did it already 20 years ago without even asking me. She said, "Oh, I'm going to put solar power on the roof," and they said, "Oh, this was a really good year. We produced so many kilowatt hours. Oh, this month was a bad month." Okay. So she really kind of sees the solar income as a real income, and I think it's true, and it's amazing. I mean, in my case, I feel like I bought the electricity for the rest of my life. The house is kind of equipped, and I would pleasure look at the statistics every day. I can download on my iPhone and see, oh, wow, how much did I produce today? Fantastic.
Now, and so again, so our listeners can kind of get a sense of this. You must have done a little bit of the calculation. You had to pay some money to have the panels put in,
yes,
construction. What's the payback period?
The interesting thing is, like, in the end, it costs us $10,000, and we're now finding out it produces twice as much than what we consume in electricity. So I was actually quite pleasantly surprised about that. And in the end, it's probably less than what many people spend on a kitchen or something. And we now know we have electricity for the rest of our lives.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but my question is this. So let's say I'm making these numbers up. Mm-hmm. So if you were paying $300 a month for electricity,
yeah,
you're now not paying that. So,
yeah, exactly.
So after the course of like 4 or 5 years, you'll have made back your investment.
Yeah. It performs better than a treasury.
Okay.
So I said, okay, rather than putting my investment into treasury, I'd rather have my PV, and I look at it and I'm proud of it. And also, I mean, it's a bit difficult to calculate what exactly is, because I'm now shielded also from rate increases.
Okay.
So my electricity costs me less than 15 cents per kilowatt hour.
That's now, can you sell the extra?
That's still, you can sell it at a very low price still, but I feel it's kind of, I'm displacing coal power, and coal power takes a lot of footprint per kilowatt hour. So even if I don't get that much money, it's also my way to compensate for my other carbon emissions, because through my work, I fly around a lot, giving workshops, talking to government officials, etc. So I emit a lot of CO2 just flying around. I bicycle to work, but but in the end, I still emit quite a bit of carbon. So I hope that's kind of my way to actively contribute.
Now, when I read Mathis, was speaking with Mathis Wackernagel, who is the president of Global Footprint Network. You know, when I read Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment and human development, you know, if I jumped around a little bit, I could get pretty depressed by some of the real, negative stuff that he pointed out that was going on in our world environmentally. So you, Optimist, pessimist? Are we better off today than we were five years ago?
I'm exhilarated.
Okay.
I mean, even by the encyclical in addition, because I think not looking at what is, that makes me depressed, because then we don't deal with it. It's like when we have a bad financial situation and we don't want to look at our bank statement. That's kind of scary. But by looking at what is and saying, okay, what can we do? Because there are lots of possibilities. That's exciting to me. So I'm quite optimistic, and I'm really pleased to see the growing interest in these matters, because we have the knowledge, we have the possibilities. It's just not doing it. That's kind of sad.
All right. So one of the things, Mathis, before I let you go, and what I'd like to do is to ask our experts like yourself to kind of make you czar of this whole thing for a while. What are the kind of two or three things, if you were the czar, that you would impose that would make things better in this area?
Yeah, I think imposing is always difficult, doesn't really work. So we have to excite people to say, yeah, that's actually in our own self-interest. But there are some big things that we can do. I mean, first is, I think, probably to recognize, are we depending on nature or not? And I think many of our planners think, oh, with money we can solve all problems. And that's probably not true in the long run. But then if we recognize our dependence on the wonderful nature we live in, what can we do? And there's some big picture items. One we talked already about. One is how do we build our cities, how design our cities, including our houses, because you can make it much more efficient. And so the way where they're compact and good for kind of a pedestrian use, that's a big issue. A second one, I would say, is the way we generate electricity. We talked about that already, like coal-powered electricity that is very resource-intensive as compared to, for example, photovoltaic. So there are great differences, and also the way we use the electricity, whether we use an incandescent bulb or we use a LED bulb, makes a big difference in our resource consumption. Then another issue that may be slightly controversial, but I think is something we are starting to address, and I see also that Pope Francis is starting to talk about that, is that population size does matter, and luckily it can be addressed in very pro-human ways. I mean, what we have seen in countries, the more we invest in young women particularly, make sure they have educational opportunities and can participate fully in society, then we see that there's a trend to smaller families, and that has also a very positive impact on children and the whole family, healthier families, better educated family, more parental care for children, so they have very positive outcomes. So I think by just encouraging that women can fully participate, which is see as a trend also in your church, which is great, is a crucial step and can stabilize situations quite significantly.
Okay, you get the job. You get the job as czar. You're the czar. You got one more thing you want to put out there?
I think the wonderful thing is that we now see that it's possible to do things, and what we start to recognize, it's not just good for the planet, it's also good for humanity, and it's also good for ourselves. And so seizing this opportunity, that's, I think, the next frontier that we can engage with. And I'm so thrilled, particularly when I speak with youth, to see kind of their eyes kind of opening up, and they're so excited about these new possibilities. So I think it's a wonderful new era we're entering into.
Matthew Wackernagel, president of Global Footprint Network, thanks so much for taking the time, and not only to sharing good information, but also sharing your enthusiasm that we actually can make a difference. We can take a step forward in being more responsible with regard to the environment, which ultimately is being more responsible about our human neighbor. So thanks for being with us. I appreciate your taking
you.
The time.
Thank you, Monsignor Kevin. It's wonderful to have such a great program, and I congratulate you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. So Tom, I think, we learned a little bit today about how far we, can take a step forward, and that I think the encyclical of Pope Francis had a major, has a major impact in raising up the issue of how much we can do about making our world a better place.
I agree, Monsignor. And, I myself was, I took the little test on the Global Footprint Network, and I found out actually it takes a little over four Earths for the world. If they all lived like me, that would take forests. So I think I have some work to do to see if I could reduce my global footprint somewhat.
But you know what I did hear? I did hear that I think you when we talked about this earlier, you told me that, you know, we're a lot of things in New York, but we do better comparatively than some of the other cities in the United States when it comes to the use of stuff.
We do. I think it ties in what Mathis was saying, sort of. I think a lot of people here in New York either take public transportation or we walk many places, as you know, right. Here. So I think, you know, from that perspective, I think that we're a step ahead of the game because, the investment we make in public transportation and just the fact that New York is so walkable.
Yeah, I think that is interesting. I always kind of balance that, though. We have so many tall buildings, so you need a lot more elevators.
Yeah, that's true.
And a lot of the buildings are sealed, so you're always either heating them or you're cooling them. So there's certainly a lot of energy that's being used in a variety of different ways.
For sure.
So, it's interesting. I do think that being more conscious of what's going on in the environment and how it affects different people is very, very important. And I know there was a little bit of kind of people said about Pope Francis that, he talked about not overdoing air conditioning. Mm. You know, some people said, oh, well, boy, that's a little bit going too much. But, you know, I got to tell you, and this I'm just speaking personally about this, is, you know, after I read that, I realized that one of the things that I think a lot of us do and that I was doing, which, you know, I've stopped doing, is when you go out, you think about when you come back in. and most of us, I think, like to say, gee, I don't want to walk into a warm house because I want it to be cool. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, sometimes, you know, you leave on the air conditioner. And I think it does depend a little bit sometimes whether you have situations where you're paying for your own electricity. Sometimes it's part of the rent. And I think sometimes people do a little bit of calculation. But one of the calculations that I think they do is, you know, I don't want to come back into a very warm apartment or something.
Exactly. No, I was guilty of that too, Monsignor. I mean, many a time I used to go out and do that, and I'd say I don't want to come back and have it be hot, so I'd leave it running. But I start to think to myself, is it really fair that I'm leaving the air conditioner in an empty room? So I've started to attend to that too, Monsignor. But that's a good thing to point out.
Yeah, and I realized, I said, so, you know, if I'm coming back in, let's say 2 hours or 3 hours, something like that, well, you know, I come back, it's going to take 10 minutes or so for the room to get cool. But I'm leaving it on for 2 or 3 hours while I'm not here. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Exactly. So, you know, and truthfully, like we heard about earlier today, you're paying for it too. So in a way, it should save me a couple of pennies in my electric bill too. Hopefully.
Here's what we're gonna do, Tom. Here's our plan.
Okay.
We'll see if we get Victoria to be part of this with us. What we're gonna do is we're gonna come up with some practical, environmentally friendly sacrifices that we can do that can make our world a better place. And take them on as penances. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to try to make Fridays penance days. We'll say, here's something we'll do a little bit extra on Fridays to do that. So anyway.
Sounds good.
Hey, thanks for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. And we got to take care of God's world. It's our world, too. We got to steward it well so that it's around for everybody. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next week on Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.